Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the YOPN Network podcast. We're joined here with two very interesting folks from the University of Illinois. We've got Mark Hesegawa Johnson and Claria Mendes. They're here to discuss some of the projects that they're working on and some of their passions that led them to those projects. So I kind of want to start off with Mark and give you a chance to introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about your background. I understand you went to a very prestigious college and have a nice degree to tell us about, and that's what's led you into this work. I read a little bit of your thesis, and I understood maybe 2% of it. So I'm interested to hear some of your explanations. How you doing, Mark?
Wow, wonderful. Thank you. I'm glad to be here, Nathan. As you said, my name is Mark Hesegawa Johnson. I'm on the faculty at the University of Illinois in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering. I was a doctoral advisee of Ken Stevens at MIT in the 1990s, which is actually where I first got involved in dysarthria. I actually was not working with dysarthria at the time, but my office mate was developing a personalized automatic speech recognition system for a professional in Boston who had dysarthria. And my work was on formant measurements for automatic speech recognition, the use of formants and burst spectral measurements, basically these knowledge designed acoustic features. And that brought me around in the mid-2000s to, well, actually, it gave me awareness of several of the faculty who were in the speech and hearing sciences department at the University of Illinois. And so when I first came here, I developed a long-term collaboration with Adrian Perlman, who is still on the faculty here. And as a result of that collaboration, we collected a database for the purpose of training speech recognizers to recognize dysarthric speech in the late 2000s. But that corpus was too small to really be useful for modern, you know, deep end-to-end deep neural network-based automatic speech recognizers. Despite being way too small, it's still the largest publicly available corpus that was collected by Heejin Kim and I in 2008. And this UA speech corpus is still maybe the largest corpus that's available for training automatic speech recognition so that it works for people who have dysarthria. That seemed to me unreasonable now that end-to-end neural networks are making it possible for speech recognition to work with error rates as low as 2% for people who speak with no disability. In particular, the reason that's happened is because there's a site called LibriVox.org where anybody can go and record an audiobook. And people will go and record an audiobook just because they love the book and they want it to be available to anybody. And neural net-based ASR has been trained on that corpus, which means that it works really, really well for people whose speech sounds like they should be narrating an audiobook and doesn't work very, very well for most other people. So maybe 3-4 years ago, I started looking around for ways in which we could try to solve this problem, to make speech recognition really work for the people for whom it would be the most useful. Fortunately, I encountered several people at the large tech companies at Apple, Amazon, Google, Meta, and Microsoft who were of the same mind, who really thought that this should be a community resource, that we should be creating data that would make it possible for any company or any university to train a speech recognizer that will actually work well for people who have a neuromotor disorder that affects their speech. And so that led me to propose to them and led them to fund the Speech Accessibility Project. We're now in the process of recruiting participants for the Speech Accessibility Project. Basically, we ask them to read sentences and to respond spontaneously to questions. Those sentences are recorded. They sign a consent form that says that they understand that this speech is going to be used to train spoken language systems by companies including Apple, Amazon, Google, Meta, and Microsoft, and by other companies and universities worldwide. And then in return, we promise that anybody who uses it is going to protect their privacy according to the best current standards of privacy protection and participant rights. So we've got that underway. We are currently recording people with Parkinson's. It's underway. I have high hopes that we basically designed this corpus so that it will be enough speech that it makes a difference. We're expecting to get 1,000 hours of transcribed speech, which should be enough so that it is possible to really train ASR so that it works with very low error rates.
What I'm hearing is that you need participation. You need folks to go to some place, which I'm assuming you can tell us, and they can actually participate, have their voice be a part of this program so that we can build out a platform to help per se, the Parkinson's community. Now, I want to give you a chance, first of all, to tell us where we can go to participate. And then I got a couple questions because you touched on a lot of stuff there, Mark.
Yes. Clarion, do you want to answer that?
So yes, we're absolutely recruiting individuals with Parkinsonian speech right now. And so we would encourage everybody to go to the following website, and that is speechaccessibilityproject.beckman.edu. And that's where folks can learn more, sign up, and potentially begin the recording process. Something that's been very exciting about this project is we are collaborating with LSVT Global, who works with a lot of individuals with speech issues that relate to Parkinson's disease. And they can help with the onboarding process for individuals that would like to share their voice with science.
So in the science, what you folks are looking for, and reading a little bit of your thesis, I kind of skipped ahead to the conclusion. You're looking for formants and burst patterns. Can you tell me what those are and how that applies to people with Parkinson's? Because I'm assuming that it's harder to detect those with people with Parkinson's, right?
It's not harder to detect the acoustic. So formants and burst spectral patterns are particular kinds of acoustic features that characterize the differences between vowels and the differences between consonants. And it's not really harder to measure them so much as we just don't have enough examples in order to know the variability. We know very well exactly what kinds of formant frequencies or burst patterns would be characteristic of those sounds for people who read audiobooks. And we don't have as clear of a knowledge of the variability of those sounds for people who have Parkinson's. And in order to make the speech technology work well, we need to be able to know not just what's the average pattern, but how does it vary across different people and across different times of day. And so absolutely, the only way forward is to make this a community project, to get as many people as possible interested and involved, and to try to understand how different people's voices differ at different times of day, saying different kinds of words, speaking in response to different kinds of prompts.
It's very interesting research to me, and I'm assuming Mike Q here as well, because we record these and then we go back and edit them. So we see these patterns that you're talking about, and it's very easy to identify each person as you're going through and editing it. As you get to the end of the hour, you can tell by looking at the pattern, okay, that's Mike's voice, or that's it. So it's interesting to me. I've noticed that, but I've never thought about it in terms of how can this affect us positively. Mike, have you ever thought like that? I notice it. Do you notice the same thing when editing?
Absolutely. I do have voice issues myself. I already signed up for your project, and thought it was very interesting. That's why I guys are here today. But what I've noticed is the word fillers, the ahs, the nos, you can just look at them, speech, whenever they talk, you can just delete them as you go. You know when they're coming up, you can see it.
I've become very accustomed to noticing the acoustic signature of an So that's a very clear one. It's very distinct. Clarion, let's bring you in and learn a little bit about you and where you tie into Mark and his research and work there in Illinois.
Absolutely.
It seems like Illinois's got a lot of resources. You guys are kicking butt.
We do. And I apologize. I think, is it Corin? Did I say that properly? Were you chiming in with a question?
Yeah, I got a question. You're very observant. I love that. If you're limiting it to U.S. residents, I wonder why that is, because wouldn't you want to pick up different accents and different speaking techniques all around? Like limiting it to just the U.S., why is it limited to just the U.S. residents? It may, it very well could, because Siri and Google don't listen to me now. It listens to everybody in my family except me.
Mm. So Corinne.
I think I got clear speech, but maybe not. I don't know.
She has a thick Newfoundland accent is all. So yes. She's our friend from the north in Canada there. Great question.
Yeah, that is a good question. Thank you. I mean, the reason is just legal. It's just to make sure that our IRB can approve our consent form and that they'll understand that everybody understands exactly what people are agreeing to and exactly what the researchers who are using the data are agreeing to. We very much hope that in the future, we will be able to expand it internationally. Right now, we're doing that, number one, for just legal reasons to make sure that, the terms of the contract are clear. And number two, to somewhat limit variability at this first phase. We are actually enrolling people who were not born in the United States. They just have to be currently residents in the United States. And we just have a binary indicator saying, do you consider U.S. English to be your native language or not? People can say yes or no if they choose to tell us that information. And then the speech recognizers may be trained differently in those two cases. We don't think we'll have enough data at this time to sort of break it down more fine-grained accent categories, but we hope to be able to do that in the future.
Well, can't pick up my newfie accent now, so I'm like ruined when I lose my voice.
Is there a point coming up where you think you'll be able to partner with facilities outside the country who maybe deal with other languages and various dialects? I could imagine that that's a very overwhelming task for one facility, one team to tackle because there's so many.
Yeah, we would certainly have to partner with people outside the country. We hope that we will be able to do that. We haven't really started making concrete plans about that yet.
It's a good direction, I think, that you're heading in. But yeah, that would be an overwhelming task, especially think about Africa, all the different dialects and sounds and whatnots that come from the various cultures there.
Is it just voice for people entering in, or is it length of diagnosis, age? Is that factors into who can enter this study?
So Clarion, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, so ideally, we want to be able to make speech recognition technology accessible, yes, to individuals with differences due to PD, but also due to other diagnoses as well. So as the project expands, we're going to be looking at collecting speech and getting participants with other speech diagnoses as well. It's really helpful to get diversity. Right now, we're really focusing on the Parkinsonian diagnoses, but it's very helpful to get diversity both sort of between individuals. So the standpoint of having folks who have been diagnosed for a relatively long time versus those diagnosed for a relatively short time, versus folks that have maybe had deep brain stimulation, folks that have, you know, may have a Parkinson's plus diagnosis, like multisystem atrophy or something along those lines. But it's also really helpful to get variability within individuals. So it can be helpful to have somebody record kind of when you're not feeling your best, because we all have to communicate when we're feeling well-rested and nourished and fulfilled. We have to communicate in those situations, but we also all have to communicate when we're feeling exhausted and cranky and tired, and maybe our speech is not quite as clear as it could be. So it's helpful to get both that within individual variability and sort of cross-sectional variability as well.
So you've got people enrolling and they're recording their voice. And usually when you're recording your voice, you're paying attention to it and you're being more, you're louder and you're really paying attention to being loud. But normally Parkinson's patients speak lower and have a lower tone. So I think that's why Siri and Google don't listen to me, because I'm such a low tone. I got to bawl at it. How are you going to factor in that when you're like that? Normally people speak in a very low tone.
No inflection in our voices. There's no voice inflection at all.
This is a place where the LSVT mentors have been helping tremendously. They, as you say, Corinne, people with Parkinson's learn to enunciate more clearly and speak more loudly when they're being recorded. And that's exactly what we don't want. We want people to speak in your sitting on your couch voice, in the voice that you would use when you were trying to relax at home and didn't have to communicate with anybody who doesn't already know you.
Yeah.
And it takes a little bit of practice sometimes for people to convince themselves that it's okay, that in fact we want you to speak with your at-home voice instead of your on-the-air voice.
So how many samples do you guys have currently, and what's your target?
We're asking participants to record 600 samples, so 450 prompts, some of which are single sentence prompts and some of which are multi-sentence. And we're trying to get 400 people with Parkinson's to make it through the protocol. We're over 100 now, so we're not quite halfway there yet.
Awesome. I know the main incentive is to, you know, further things that benefit people with Parkinson's, but do you guys have any other incentives for people attached to this that folks out there listening should know about?
Yes, we are also giving a cash reimbursement, actually Amazon e-cards. We every 200 utterances that you record, we send a $60 Amazon e-card to your email account so that you can buy things.
Something that I think is important to add to that is because there's so much variability in technical skill, as well as a lot of variability in severity levels, there's also the option for somebody to have a assistant with them, and that individual will also get e-code as well for the labor of assisting with the recording process. So spouses have joined into siblings, children, et cetera, et cetera. It's become kind of a family project to share the voice.
So do you have places that if people are very technology, struggle with technology, is there a place they can go in and do it in person? Is that an option or is it got to be done online?
We haven't really set it up for that right now, no. We've been relying on having a family member or a friend who's able to help you log into the site.
I would think that with the LSVT attachment that they would have connections for folks. And if I'm maybe making an assumption, Mark, but I'm sure that they would offer that if that came to it, Corinne. That's a very good point. Maybe you guys could bring that up to them and put that out there. I don't know how many people would really go out and do that though. I love the incentive that you guys have attached with the money. Money always talks and pushes people. And I kind of knew that you guys had that. That's why I brought it up. I wanted to throw it over to Clary, and she's come across as kind of your sidekick here, but I know that you've got some clinical experience of your own and some gusto behind you. So if you don't mind, just tell us a little bit about you. What brings you to the team?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. So I am a speech language pathologist. Well, that's embarrassing, flubbing my title, you know.
That's a bad thing to mess
right?
up.
Right? Oh my gosh. And I'm a clinical assistant professor here at the University of Illinois. And I've been teaching at the graduate level in the field of motor speech disorders for 10 or 11 years now. And so that kind of relates to the fact that before I joined the university full-time, I was working in skilled nursing environments, and a lot of my clients there would be diagnosed with PD, and there was often this sense of withdrawal. So as people were less and less understood, there was less autonomy, there was less willingness to express one wants and needs. So just as one example, I remember a patient expressing to me, "Why do they always give me apple juice at breakfast? I hate apple juice." But he got so tired of not being understood or not heard that he just withdrew and became more and more passive. So that's just, you know, one example. I've also been very active with the Parkinson's disease support group locally for about 7 years now. And they're a very active bunch. And something that has really inspired me is to have them listen to the fact that because so many folks live with Parkinson's disease for decades, it's become really this a chronic situation that people might work for a long period of time with and raise their children. And I know I'm really speaking to the choir here. So I was really compelled to, with my clients, help so that they can communicate and participate in those activities of daily living and leisure activities for as long as possible. And as speech recognition technology is becoming so pervasive for folks that don't have speech impairments, it becomes really important not to, you know, increase the digital divide as far as that's concerned. And so my job as far as the project is concerned is evaluating a lot of those speech samples to sort of identify what is making them different from what we would expect when somebody typically opens up their mouth. I've also worked really closely with our fantastic linguist, Heejin Kim, designing many of the prompts that Mike spent many hours recording to make them as functional and representative as possible for folks. And also sort of working very closely with the LSVT team to help troubleshoot any particular issues related to the recording process. Also working with the team here at Illinois to help shape kind of the next phase of the project as we start having more diverse diagnoses share their voices as well.
And so where do the two of you see the next phase of this project going? What is the end goal here, clearly stated in layman's terms for folks that are listening?
Well, we can talk about a short-term goal for which we have concrete plans and a long-term goal for which we don't yet have concrete plans. Our short-term goal for which we have concrete plans is to begin recruiting also from other etiologies, from other groups of people who have neuromotor disorders that affect their speech, with the goal of getting a total of 1,000 hours of speech from a total of 2,000 people that we can then provide to Apple, Amazon, Google, Meta, and Microsoft, and also to other universities and companies so that they can solve this problem. So that basically people speaking in English to an automatic speech recognizer, to their cell phone or their smart speaker or their computer, will be able to get information from those devices exactly the same way that people who don't have that disorder are able to do. We think that it's possible to collect that 1,000 hours and to make that and that will make a significant difference within a fairly short period of time, within really a couple of years. In the longer run, if we are able to then extend this project beyond next year, it would be really great to go internationally, as we've discussed already, to be able to partner with organizations in other countries in order to try to collect data in other dialects of English and or in other languages in order to make it possible to make speech technology accessible in other languages and other dialects as well.
So how does this speech technology work? How would it ultimately affect me as a person with Parkinson's? As my voice starts to deteriorate, how can I expect your research to pan out into a functional device or something that's useful for me in my life?
Mm-hmm. When it works well, it's almost invisible. So we're talking about every device that currently can be accessed by speech. Smart speakers that you would set on your counter and use to check the weather outside or play music. Cell phones that you could use voice dialing in order to call people instead of using instead of typing. Even possibly writing email and accessing web pages on your computer or accessing television. Any place where you can imagine that it's annoying to have to use a keyboard and wouldn't it be nice if I could just talk to this device? Many of those places are available now for people who don't have any dysarthria and are just not available for people who do have dysarthria, and we want to make them available. We want that transition as your speech starts to become affected by your Parkinson's. We want your device not to notice the difference. We want your device to continue working just as it does now.
So I've got two questions, one for each of you. First of all, for the teacher, if you could, what is dysarthria, if I can even say that? Can you describe it? I think I know, but can you describe it to us?
That's a great question. So dysarthria is a speech diagnosis that can be sort of acquired in two ways. It can be present at birth. So that might be the circumstance with somebody with, for instance, cerebral palsy or Down syndrome, or very often it's something that's acquired due to some sort of neurological event. It can be something that happens very acute or abruptly. So in the situation of somebody having a stroke or a brain injury, or it can happen gradually over time. And that's what you see in individuals with PD or ALS, those sorts of diagnoses. And what occurs is there's a disconnect between the neurons and the portions of the brain that create speech motor patterns and the communication from those patterns, from those areas of the brain and from those neurons to the muscles of speech. And it's really interesting, and I'd love to circle back for just a moment to what Mike said about there's no inflection in our speech. I think it's really important to highlight that speech is not just the articulators, it's not just the voice, but it also impacts that inflectional patterns, breathing, telling jokes, things like that. So that's what is occurring with dysarthria.
Thank you. My other question was for Mark. When you get this technology and it's to the point where you are ready to go forward with it, can you please give it to the telemarketers first or the people who have the 1-800 lines that you have to go through all those prompts that can never hear you correctly? That's who needs the voice recognition fix.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
I'm just joking. Mike, you had your hand up. What was your question, my friend?
Do you clown around? Do you ever deal with people with spasmodic dysphonia?
So something about spasmodic dysphonia, I apologize. I did not catch that first part.
It's okay. I have voice issues, so I get Do you deal with people with spasmodic dysphonia? Do you deal with anybody that has spasmodic dysphonia and Parkinson's?
So spasmodic dysphonia and Parkinson's disease, let's unpack those things for a moment. So dysarthria is very commonly associated with Parkinson's disease, and it's specifically the hypokinetic type. So the movements of the articulators, including your lips, your tongue, your jaw, the valving mechanism of your larynx, or you know, more commonly known as your voice box, and that kind of relates, circles way back to what Mark was saying about the changes in vowel formants being smaller. So that's the hypokinetic dysarthria piece. Mike is talking about also having spasmodic dysphonia, which is a relatively mysterious neurological condition where there's excess tension in the vocal folds. And there are two types. It can either kind of make the muscles paralyzed into more of a closed position. So in that case, the voice sounds very tight. I'm not trying to do any mocking activities there, but Mike can probably share with us that it's also sometimes makes swallowing very uncomfortable. It can make speech very fatiguing. There's also another type where the voice sounds very breathy, where the vocal folds are in an open position. And unfortunately, it can be relatively difficult to treat. Some people find a lot of success with behavioral speech therapy. Some people find success with Botox injections. They're not just for wrinkles, folks. They're also there for your vocal mechanism. But it is a very frustrating, very fatiguing comorbid diagnosis. I'm sorry that I don't have a magic wand for you here today, Mike, but it does make that... It's interesting because it makes, most of the time we can understand somebody with spasmodic dysphonia, but this voice sounds very atypical. It's not what one would expect whatsoever.
And the more we speak, the tighter our voice gets.
Exactly.
It's very interesting to listen to old shows of the Mike and Mike and how your voice has changed. You can kind of listen to your progression if you go back through the shows and go in order. And that this condition that Mike has is actually what brings me here. Mike asked me to help him out with the show because his voice is starting to get in that condition. And I think that was probably what led your interest to these folks, right, Mike?
Exactly.
Yeah, so a lot of the questions that I'm asking are actually formed by Mike here. We get together ahead of these and have conversations about the folks that we're going to talk to, and I get an idea of what Mike wanted to ask, but unfortunately doesn't have the ability to always do anymore. What's up, Grin?
So is there a plan to track these individuals long-term and see if this actually works with the same individuals? And track the progression because their disease will progress. So are they going to be tracked long term?
We are not tracking from our side, but what we're doing is we're giving people the option to tell us that we can give your name and your email address to other people who will do studies related to Parkinson's disease. The NIH has a large multi-site study going on right now, for example, on voice as a biomarker for health, looking at the changes in voice long-term as a result of Parkinson's disease. And so if participants in our study express interest, you know, basically click the box that says they want to do this, then we'll make your name and email address available to other studies who are interested in tracking in the long-term. from our point of view, we want to collect, you know, our goal is blinders on, squarely straight ahead. We want to make speech technology accessible to you. And so we want to collect the data and give it to the researchers who will be able to make that happen.
So bouncing off of Corinne's question, and with your knowledge of technology, do you foresee kind of a merging of this voice recognition with artificial intelligence that may be able to detect these changes as we go? So maybe the two combined could have some sort of an effect on progression, monitoring, things of that nature, and then possibly giving data to our speech pathologists that they could monitor.
Yes, absolutely. I think a lot of the engineering is in place to make that happen. And the only thing that's really absent is the sort of the technical and convention framework necessary to protect your privacy in doing so, to make sure that whatever information you give to whoever you give it to is used only and exactly in the ways that you want it to be used. And so if you want to have the data go to your speech pathologist, it should be possible for you to make that happen. I think the technology is there and we're just missing the standards.
What I'm hearing you say is that very soon we'll have the technology that's in place serve us better through the technological advances that you folks are making there in Illinois.
That's what I believe, yes.
This is amazing. What do you think, Corinne?
Well, I think we have our own little dialect here in Newfoundland, and Siri and Google don't listen to me now. So I'm interested to see how this is going to go, because maybe it'll make Siri listen to me finally and get some of my text messages right, because they don't get it right now. So I think this is going to be very positive, and I think it could definitely benefit a lot of people.
I just want to add that New England has its own dialect too.
Yes.
Everybody does. Everybody does.
I agree 100%, Mike. When my parents come to visit me, nobody understands my dad when he walks around town.
Yeah, yours is gone. If you guys are from the same place, you don't sound like it.
No, she sounds like she's from Midwest now.
Yeah. So, Mark, reading through your thesis in 1996, you seemed like a very hopeful student that one day you might kind of get to the point that you're at now. And I kind of felt proud for you while I was reading through that, because I got a sense of the direction you were headed when reading the conclusion. And how do you feel now looking back when thinking about that guy that you were? Is this kind of where you thought you'd end up?
Yes, I'm very grateful to the opportunities that I've had to. There's a saying that in a democracy, we put in power the people who will use that power to serve those who put them there. And I've been given a lot of privileges in my life, and I try to use those privileges in order to give back.
Despite the fact that Mark is a world-renowned engineer, I would still make the argument that he remains to this day a hopeful student. So that has not gone away.
I think that when you are diagnosed with Parkinson's, you have to become a hopeful student. And if you don't, it kind of goes downhill for you, because first of all, you have to have hope and you have to become a student of the disease. You have to learn these things that Clarion was mentioning about how not only your voice, but your body, everything starts to shrink down. And that's where I like the association with LSVT, with their Big and Loud program. It's exactly what they're doing, is opening us up, right? Be it our voice, be it our body. And that's kind of, I myself in the exercise profession, that's what we want to do with folks. We want to make sure that you're active, that you're out there moving and getting those muscles opened up, getting the blood flow going. So Corinne, I am very surprised that you've not chimed in more. If you guys knew Corinne and how she actually is, she's very, very, very talkative. What is on your mind, Mike?
Talking a lot. I was trying to let other people speak because I don't stop. And I think that sometimes I can overpower conversations because I practice speech a lot. I'm very good at practicing my speech. So I talk probably 90% of my day.
So what do you suggest, Clarion, is the number one thing that folks can do at home by themselves to maintain their vocal throughout progression? What is the number one thing we can do? Is it just talking? Is it just socializing?
Socializing. You said it right there. So when we socialize, we don't do it silently, right? When we socialize, we talk, we communicate, we engage with others. And so by socializing, you're immediately going to use that voice more. You're probably going to move your body more. You're probably going to, you know, not ward off, but decrease, you know, depression and isolation and that kind of thing. I really love any sort of activities that sort of can, even though my specialty is speech and voice, it diminishes us if we think of ourselves as just our speech or our voice. We're a whole person. So with socializing, we're using our whole selves, our whole person, and maintaining our voice while we're doing it.
So I'm really bad with technology, really bad. And when I get to these prompts where it's voice recognition, I just keep hitting zero until it gets me to where I want to go because it never recognizes anything I say. So with technology changing and everything going facial recognition now, because I got to use my face to get in anything. Are you guys looking at anything along them lines? Because Parkinson's can affect that too. So is there any ideas or thoughts on looking at facial recognition software and anything that can be done with that?
That's something we haven't thought about at all, actually. We haven't.
I think you could make a connection maybe if the formant has some sort of a connection to the way that the lips move. Maybe we could do some study in that field, see if there's, and then we could connect it to the facial recognition. We're connecting technologies on this show today. We're
going to, because it never recognizes my face either. I don't like technology.
So what made you think, Mark, about formants, about these burst patterns? What made you think about the electronics behind this? Like, where does your engineer brain and Parkinson's come together? Where did we meet, my friend?
I think it comes from my doctoral advisor, Ken Stevens, had this philosophy that computers can learn whatever humans already know, but that we won't understand what the computers are missing unless we also understand it as scientists. And so formants and burst spectral patterns are a good example. These are measurements that we use to characterize speech patterns in scientific analysis. They're not necessarily necessary to train an automatic speech recognizer, but they're quite useful in helping to understand what the speech recognizer has learned. And so it's this philosophy of sort of bridging the gap. And if we're trying to understand the different patterns in speech, actually, that can help us to understand why the speech recognizer is not understanding people with Parkinson's. We can look and say, oh, well, in what ways are the formants being reduced by this hypokinetic dysarthria? And in what ways are the pitch patterns being changed by the dysphonia? Having understood that as scientists, sometimes we can figure out how to change the technology.
So in your research, have you noticed any patterns so far? Like, for example, with folks who have DBS or folks who are at a certain progression, is there any data that's suggesting one thing leads to vocal performance at certain levels? Or
I haven't looked at the variations a lot. Clarion, do you have answers to that?
So Nathan, just to clarify, do you mean within the data that we're collecting here or just sort of across the board?
I guess I would have to have you speak to both. I'm assuming you haven't really gathered enough data to make that conclusion yet. But within your I guess, knowledge, do you expect maybe to have any issues with DBS that maybe vocal performance is affected in some certain way? Are there any patterns that you're noticing with people who have DBS versus people who don't?
Absolutely. So I will mention that when I'm evaluating the speech of individuals that are sharing their voice with our project, I don't know who has DBS and who doesn't. I'll be honest, sometimes I like to guess who has had DBS and who hasn't. It's pretty well established that folks who've had a deep brain stimulator will enjoy a lot of physical improvements, but it's often at the expense of a vocal and speech decline. So some of the things that are pretty common with individuals who've had DBS are kind of increased instances of repeating patterns. So sometimes somebody might describe it as like they're stuttering, like repeating a sound over and over again. Something that we see very commonly is more of that tightness or roughness in the larynx. So the voice might sound a little bit tighter. It might sound more dysphonic. That's something we see quite a bit with DBS. Very anecdotally, something I'm seeing quite a bit lately is something called diplophonia. And that's when the vocal folds, so there's two of them, and in an ideal world, they're vibrating at exactly the same frequency. In circumstances where they're not vibrating at the same frequency, you'll kind of hear, it's almost as if the speaker is speaking at two different pitches simultaneously. And so that's something that I hear sometimes with DBS. That last one's very anecdotal.
Now, do you notice that these go along with dysphagia or dysphagia? I don't know how you would say that.
Both are completely appropriate ways to pronounce that. So dysphagia is disordered swallowing that can be very common with Parkinson's disease as it progresses. A lot of the neural pathways that are involved in speech are also involved with swallowing. So it's not too uncommon for folks that have difficulty with spoken communication due to PD to also have difficulty with swallowing. Oftentimes I've had people, you know, explain to me that sometimes their dysphagia symptoms can really be modified by their medication. So sometimes they might not have a whole lot of difficulty with it, but other times it might take a little bit longer to eat. There might be more instances of coughing, throat clearing, that kind of thing.
Mike, what's your biggest hope for technology of the future? What would be the biggest help to you to get through your everyday life?
Physically, I'm fine, but Larry mentioned it earlier. She said, the voice with DBS, I have DBS. I tend to seize up sometimes, I can do it right now. And the voice follows suit with it. So if you can do any kind of relief with the voice, so I can speak normal again, I would love that personally.
Now, on that note, do you guys have any hope that these technologies, it's one thing for our voices to be recognized as they progress. Do you have any hope that there's improvements from these technologies that can be made on people's vocal performance? I know that's, you know, the whole hope for speech pathology, right, is to make some improvements and make these people better. So I'm assuming that's the direction you're heading, right?
That's not an immediate goal of this project, but that is that is one of the goals, I think, of the NIH's Voice as a Biomarker for Health project, to be able to better understand the progression of the decline of the voice and the decline of the speech through the disease, with the hope that perhaps something can be done to ameliorate or reverse it. Clarion?
So I think I am hopeful that it could have potential for improving the voice and speech of individuals with PD, because something we know now is the earlier we provide that intervention for speech and voice, the more successful folks are communicating for a longer period of time. A lot of voice therapy and speech therapy used in Parkinson's disease is really heavy-duty physical exercise that helps prevent, you know, decline over time. And so if we can have those vocal biomarkers that may diagnose somebody earlier, we have the opportunity to thus intervene even earlier. So I could see that, you know, oftentimes I see the technology and the behavioral speech and voice therapy as being complementary, but not necessarily intersectional. But this is kind of an opportunity where maybe those things could connect directly.
You're speaking like I'm on an episode of The Jetsons. Are you telling me at one point in the future, I might go to my refrigerator and it will recognize my voice and say, you've got Parkinson's? Are we going to be diagnosed by our technology and its voice recognition possibly through this study that you guys are doing?
Not with our study, but it's my understanding that the NIH biomarker study is headed in that direction. Do I understand that correctly, Mark?
Yeah, I think that's one of their objectives, and that might be low-hanging fruit that they actually are looking to be more precise about exactly how long it's been since your diagnosis, or if you haven't been diagnosed yet, or, you know, exactly what the comorbidities may be.
So since we're, you know, talking pie in the sky hopes, and we've got a real deal scientist here, What do you foresee before you leave this earth? Where do you see the advancements in technology going? What's your hope anyways?
My hope is that this becomes a curb cuts sort of phenomenon where the technology that we're developing that helps people with Parkinson's to be better understood by their devices will encourage broader acceptance of speech-enabled AI as a general enhancement of human ability universally for every human being, that we will be able to communicate with other people and with information seamlessly all the time whenever we want it. I like to think about this as a curb cuts phenomenon where I'm focusing on Parkinson's because that's a group that for which the existing technology doesn't work. But if we can make it work for people with Parkinson's, and then that will encourage a broader use generally and broader enhancement of human abilities universally.
It has to be an exciting time to be you because I can see all of these technologies coming together right now. And for you folks to be doing this study, all that does is enhance a lot of the other technologies that are about to really come of age, I think, very soon for us, which I think a lot of the hope is for a cure. A hope is for a new medicine that's going to help. But really, we should also be excited about the technological advances. And I think that's a really cool thing that we've got, not only doctors of medicine working for people with Parkinson's, but we've got folks like you who are out there really finding ways of tangible things that we can implement in our lives without us even having to make effort. That's the best part about what you guys are doing, is this is just going to be something that affects us. We're going to see it come of age without having a choice, which I don't mind. And it's going to be something that we just benefit from. So thank you on behalf of everybody.
I just want to reiterate what Claren mentioned earlier. If having voice problems, don't stay home. Go out and socialize. I speak with these guys all week because we do this all the time. And they are part of my life now. I go to the gym and people over there, if they don't understand me, they simply ask what I said again. They come closer to me. People will listen to you, so you have to stay social. Otherwise, the depression will hit and you fall apart when that happens.
Mike, I'm so grateful that you have maintained your activity in this podcast. I think that your voice, be it as it is one of the most important voices our community could possibly hear. Because when it comes to folks who get those troubles, those communication troubles, that is socialization. That's everything. We can look at primates, and the vocalizations that they made was the communication. It's kind of gone on since then. So to diminish that takes your social structure and diminishes it. So to keep you involved in this show, we've got myself, Corinne now joined us, Gavin joins us from time to time, Heather. We're all really close friends as well, and we collaborate, and these projects are very important. I got one last question for Clarion. You've got a lot of experience working in the lives of people. What's your favorite story? What's your biggest success that you've had to date?
Oh, my goodness. Let's see. That's a really hard question to answer, and I'm not trying to be cagey, but everybody's win is going to be individual, right? And so everybody's win is going to be individual. So there's one that I'm particularly proud of. And I was working with this gentleman who had Parkinson's disease, but he also had another neurological condition as well. So it's sort of simultaneous. This gentleman was kind of later stage in his diagnosis, and he had dysphagia that at that point was intractable. So it was not really going to get better, and we did our best to manage it. But I realized that if this gentleman could sleep in an appropriate position, he seemed to be, the data seemed to suggest that he aspirated, so saliva was going into his stomach rather than in his lungs. We don't want that. Lungs aren't hungry. They're not thirsty. And so if he had a hospital bed, he would be able to, you know, sleep more safely. And he was at the nursing home, and really he couldn't go home unless he had access to a hospital bed. So I was able to negotiate with his insurance company that it would cost them a lot less money if they would just send him home with a hospital bed rather than send him home without one, because I said, he will definitely be back here if that's the case. And so they said, yes, I agree. And so he was able to stay at home, live happily with his wife because of that modification. And so he had that socialization piece, that sort of thing, were able to give him a much higher quality of life because of fighting for those resources for him.
I think that speaks to the diverse care team that we're supposed to really embrace once we're diagnosed with this disease. A primary care physician isn't going to cut it, guys. We need to include clinicians of various practices so that things like this can be noticed. And I've got one last question. I lied. What's your biggest hope for your students now that you're a teacher? I was asking you about your past. I want to ask you now about your present. What's your biggest hope for your students? Because ultimately, they're going to be the ones to take this research forward, right?
My biggest hope for my students is that they never stop learning. That might sound cliche, but one of the things that's exciting about this field is it's never boring. There's always more to know. There's always more to learn. And that is my biggest hope for my students.
All right, Mark, do you have any final words for us? We're coming up close to this hour, Mark. I think that you probably have had that hope for a long time for your students as well. How does it feel to have somebody like Clarion and probably the rest of your team? I'm sure you've got some bright individuals under you. How does it feel to be leading such a project?
You know, it makes me very proud to be working with people who have the skills that that Clarion and Heejin and Meg and Eric and Jenna have. It's been a remarkable team, and this team works together very well. I just wanted to comment that, I mean, maybe leaning back to something that Mike mentioned, that, you know, the standard definition of, we were talking about what is dysarthria. Dysarthria can be defined as a loss of intelligibility caused by a neuromotor disorder. And the key thing to observe there is that the loss of intelligibility is actually not the speaker's problem originally, it's the hearer's problem. And disability generally is defined as the inability to do some things because of differences in your neuromotor coordination. But the inability to do things is defined by the people who created that device or who created that technology or that building. And so in a very real sense, if the technology works, then you're no longer disabled.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but I am going to take what you just said and play it on loop for my wife over and over and over again. It's on the listener, honey.
So, Mike, I got to go back to you and I got to say, don't ever silence your voice, because what you have to say is so impactful on the Parkinson's community. And it doesn't matter how you say it, because it's just the impact that you make. And you made such an impact on my life. You've involved me in all of this. And you're an inspirational man. And back to you guys, what motivated you to do this research?
I would say that it's kind of rare as an engineer that we really get to work so closely with people who can possibly benefit so much from the work that we're doing. And so it's, you know, to have such clear goals, to be able to say that if we can just cross this one bridge, then this technology will be available to, you know, to these million people. That's a remarkable experience.
They say the government's like so many years ahead of the public sector in technology. Do you think the government's got voice recognition technology already that's ahead of you, or are you really the cutting edge here?
For understanding what you say, no, I think that the government is not ahead of us in understanding what you say in American English. They may have recognition for particular security reasons for other languages that we don't have in the public. But I think for American English recognition, what we're doing is pretty close to the state of the art.
Clarion, can you mention for us again where folks can go so that they can be a part of this research and get their voices heard?
Absolutely. So we encourage everybody to go to speechaccessibilityproject.beckman.illinois.edu. And folks can both find out more about the study there, as well as sign up either to participate or also just sign up for general updates to see what we're doing.
All right, folks, go there and check it out. And that wraps us up for the day.